Welcome, everyone, to another edition of ACE's Patient-Focused Update, the podcast for Americans for Safe Access, the nation's leading organization fighting for the rights of all patients who use cannabis medicinally. You can find out more at safeaccessnow.org. And joining us on the program today, we have Dr. Jehan Marku, who's the Chief Science Officer for ACE. Jehan, welcome back.
Hello, thank you.
I think the most pressing thing for us to talk about, and by the time our listeners hear this, it may have already been resolved or not, but it's the looming threat on Capitol Hill of a government shutdown as Republicans in the House and the Senate can't seem to come up with a way to continually fund the government. And I'm curious, since we have so much intersection with federal policy when we talk about medical marijuana and the DOJ and their ability to go after patients, especially since we've had the rescinding of some of these memos, and we'll talk about that a little later. But can you give us an idea politically what we're looking at here as far as this government shutdown and how it might affect patients?
Yeah, so just a little bit of background. People saw this coming. It's something that Jeff Sessions was very clear about making happen as part of his agenda. So, at the end of 2017, federal protections for medical cannabis and providers started to hang in the balance. Previously, Congress has had three times pass the stopgap funding measure that included the CJS medical marijuana amendment, extending the restrictions on the Department of Justice and therefore the DEA, until January 19th. Now, this is something that's been tried for about a decade before it started getting passed. And so what we're looking at tomorrow is probably a delay because of the government shutdown. And so the fate of medical cannabis protections will be decided by negotiations between the House and Senate on the fiscal year 18 appropriations bill. And Sessions has urged Congress not to extend this protective amendment to the Commerce, Justice, and Science, the CJS budget amendment. Earlier this year, the amendment was blocked from being considered by the House committee. And again, remember, this was first introduced in 2001, and it didn't get approved until the first time it was approved was 2014. So I think some of us are worried about is that it is kind of hanging in the balance. If there is a vote on it tomorrow, we don't know if we'll have the support to get it passed by our elected officials, or it might be delayed until February 16th.
And that would be in the case if they're doing that continuing resolution that might be one of their stopgap solutions?
Yeah, and we don't really, no one has a really good crystal ball to predict what will happen. But I think people should really start being prepared for the event that raids will increase. And I think it's a bit of a misunderstanding to kind of yawn at the potential of a raid from the current administration, because they've still been happening. They've been happening at the state level. We've seen, in Indiana, CBD product suppliers were raided. We've seen, they haven't been happening with support of the DOJ, but they've still been quietly happening here or there in states. And we're really nervous that this will cause an upswell in the ability for the DOJ to go after cannabis operators they don't like. And so we've been really pushing dispensary staff and other people who work at cannabis operations to be trained on what to do in the event of a raid. And not just for your safety and protection, but for your patients and their caregivers who are in your dispensary in the event that there is a federal law enforcement interaction. Is your staff ready? Would they know what to say? And I think that is a really important and hard question to ask. What would your staff say if they were, separated and questioned by the DEA and asked, like, who owns this? How much cannabis is here? Would they know what to say? Would they know what the magic words are when dealing with law enforcement? And if you're wondering what those magic words are, I choose to remain silent and I want to see a lawyer. And I would say that you should teach that to everyone you know, everyone you work with, your family members, your neighbors, because you want to be prepared. You don't want to be caught in a chaotic situation and not ready for it. If you want to learn more about what it was like to live in a in the pre-Cole memo era. We have posted a webinar recently free on our YouTube channel for ASA that goes into more detail about the history of this and also talks with providers who were raided and showing pictures from the raids and discussing how and why these were conducted.
Let's talk a little bit more about the federal policy, because I recently saw news concerning the Veterans Administration and Secretary David Shulkin being caught in somewhat of a misstatement and with regard to VA policy with medical cannabis. Could you give us a little insight on that?
So to put it in context, on December 8th, the Department of Veteran Affairs updated their policy, encouraging the Veterans Health Administration healthcare providers to discuss cannabis use with veterans. Now, the VA physicians are still barred from completing the state paperwork required for veterans to register, but the new directive states veterans must not be denied services solely because they are participating in state-approved marijuana programs. And I think this is an important step, and I think it's worth mentioning that due to the Conant decision in federal court, physicians are allowed to discuss pros and cons of patients regardless of their status in a cannabis program, registered or not. So the VA directive 2017-1315 replaces the 2011 directive that technically expired in 2016 but remained the department policy. So this new directive encourages the Veteran Health Administration providers to discuss cannabis with any veteran seeking information about it, including potentially how to treat medical or psychiatric conditions. So, you know, the pros and cons of using it for different conditions and may relate, you know, it to other medications or aspects of overall care. So I think this is basically updating their policy to be more in line with the rights that doctors already have who aren't part of the VA.
And also recently, there was a plea from the veteran service organizations, many veterans and activists, to ask why the VA research facilities aren't studying medical cannabis use for our veterans. And the secretary of the VA said they weren't allowed to. Turns out they are allowed to. It's just hard. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, I think that, you know, to be a little brusque, I'd say, you know, it's a little bit of put up or shut up. You know, it is hard to do research. Life is hard, too. But, you know, just saying I don't want to fill out the paperwork, they won't let me do research is really I mean, there's lots of people doing cannabis research. John Hopkins is doing inhaled cannabis, THC and CBD studies right now. You know, we are seeing kids given CBD all across the country and in university and controlled settings. So, you know, research is happening. It is difficult. It is hard. You got to, you know, cross every T, dot every I, and go through a very antiquated system of application, review, and processing. And I think that, you know, that's a lot of people aren't driven enough to do it. So I think that we need to update the way we talk about research, saying, yeah, there are barriers to research. It's a lot of paperwork. It takes a long time, but it is possible. And we are seeing more and more clinical trials starting in the U.S. and abroad with U.S. collaborators.
Well, that's good news. Now let's take a look at another arm of the federal government, the Drug Enforcement Administration, which apparently has been forced to correct some misinformation that had been promulgated. Can you give us more detail?
This is my favorite story of 2017, I think. ASA filed a legal request with the Department of Justice demanding that the DEA immediately remove from their website and materials more than 25 false statements on the DEA's website and educational materials about cannabis, which constituted a violation of the Information Quality Act, otherwise known as the Data Quality Act, which requires that administrative agencies, therefore government agencies, may not provide false information to the public. And they have to respond to requests for correction of information within 60 days. So what we did at ASA is we basically, after the DEA put out their denial of rescheduling petition, we went through that entire petition, including the published study that they just sort of stapled onto the back of it. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it's like a very short report by the DEA, and then they just staple, like, you know, let's paperclip a previously published research article to our report. So we took that information, and what they said in the public space when they denied cannabis, this is actually cannabis fulfills many of the factors required for rescheduling. You know, it's medical efficacy, it's known, the products can be standardized. We've seen this with Sativex and Bedrocan and other cannabis products that have been used in studies. And we took what they said in public about the denial of rescheduling, and then compared that with what they say on their website, the information they give to government officials, information they give to teachers, and it turns out that they were vastly different. When they were denying the rescheduling petition, they said that there were no long-term consequences of cannabis use on cognitive function, citing one or two studies. Very surprising coming from the DEA. However, on their website, you could find materials for the public that said that a single use of marijuana would cause irreversible damage to the brain. And so we said, well, this is what they said in this official report. This is what they say in their educational materials. This is what they say in their materials that they share with the government. We even went so far as to compare the quality of the references they use. And it turns out that for a lot of their their educational documents, and for example, the dangers and consequences of marijuana use, or dangers and consequences of drug use, they had this series of booklets. Those were largely research that was published, 30 years ago, never reproduced. A lot of it was their own press releases. And so basically they removed the dangers and consequences of cannabis, or dangers and consequences of marijuana, from their website. It got removed under pressure from the Information Quality Act because it actually contained 23 factual inaccuracies in violations of the IQA. And so basically they yielded to pressure and removed misinformation on cannabis from their website.
That's fantastic. I love that we get the law working on our side at the federal level. It's a great story from 2017. Now, I also want to take a look at what's happening here in 2018. I just got finished watching some testimony in the House of Representatives, a meeting in the House of Representatives that was focused on cannabis. And next thing you know, one of these anti-cannabis Republicans is bringing up the opioid crisis. And oh no, marijuana is the gateway to opioids and addiction. And of course, we know that's not true. I'd like to know more about what Americans for Safe Access is doing on this issue to educate and let the general public know that marijuana is the gateway out of the opioid crisis.
Thank you, Russ. So ASA launched a comprehensive campaign on cannabis, as a tool in the opioid crisis. And I think we believe at ASA that this is a blueprint for state policy. And David Mangone and Beth Collins, Marissa Valerie, Jeffrey Marshall, and Debbie Churgay at the ASA office have really been working feverishly on this campaign, because what it points out to us is that, one, the adult use market, the rec market, does not provide access to everyone, because, and neither does the medical cannabis market. There's still a large portion of people who aren't allowed to access it because they're on prescription medications, such as for opiates. They could lose those prescription medications. They could lose access to their healthcare by testing positive for a Schedule I substance. There are people where chronic pain is not recognized as a treatment condition. Places like New Jersey, which are surrounded by states that allow chronic pain for the longest time, did not recognize chronic pain, still pretty much does not. But, Delaware, Pennsylvania does. So we had this patchwork of states where people with chronic pain conditions could access cannabis, but there still were some issues. But we have a guidebook, a free guidebook called Medical Cannabis as a Tool to Combat Pain in the Opioid Crisis, a Blueprint for State Policy. This covers legislative and regulatory solutions, model legislation, emergency proclamations, and flow charts, and tons of data to help lawmakers identify these barriers to access. And already elements of ASA's model legislation are being implemented in D.C., in the District of Columbia, in an effort to reduce opioid overdose deaths. And I think that in tandem with the release of this report, we held several rallies on November 1st, in D.C. with the U.S. Pain Foundation, We held a rally with Congressman Earl Blumenauer, and this was all to encourage policymakers to consider medical cannabis as an option. A lot of advocates delivered letters to the leadership of the Senate and House committees on appropriation, you know, also urging them to include the CJS amendment in the appropriations package. Again, this was also, we have to remember that the President's Commission on Drug Abuse and Combating Opioid Crisis, they had this commission come out, which pretty much ignored any scientific data. And so they omitted basically all available clinical research data on the safety and effectiveness of cannabis for treating chronic pain. I just want to say that they omitted, as in they did not include available clinical research data on the safety and effectiveness of cannabis in their official report. So ASA filed two requests under the Freedom of Information Act to make the commission disclose how they drafted the final report, because it looks like that it was drafted with a very narrow scope and really no experts, people who have experience doing any research on cannabis, whether for abuse or for therapeutic purposes. So it was really questionable where they got their information from and what information they used for their effort to combat the opioid epidemic.
Well, thanks for taking that on and giving the public more than enough information to make the right decision with regard to cannabis and opioids. It just it's remarkable to me that we still have to do this, but we still have to do this. Let's take a look now at another popularly known molecule, CBD, cannabidiol. You've got some information about the World Health Organization taking a look at this.
Yeah, so the WHO initial reports, their sort of report before they make an official report, or the report to help them write the official report, says CBD needs no restrictions. And so we have to remember, although it's scientifically unfair and politically untenable, I think, CBD is a Schedule I substance in the United States and internationally scheduled by the Narcotics Council at the UN. So this was a big move on the international stage, where the World Health Expert Committee on Drug Dependence announced that it is determined that CBD does not require international scheduling, the classification system that restricts access to drugs, to put it, to use a euphemism. The initial findings lay the foundation for a full review of CBD and other cannabis-related substances. So maybe we might see other cannabinoid compounds of some 60 to 100 or so that have been identified up for consideration as well. So there's going to be a May meeting in 2018, which will include a special session on cannabis to cover the cannabis plant, resin, extracts, tinctures, THC and CBD and related compounds. So findings about the drug safety and efficacy by the WHO have influence on federal agencies such as the FDA, Health and Human Services, because drug scheduling in the U.S. is tied to international treaties. So the WHO asked, in advance of the WHO meeting, the FDA asked for input on CBD and 16 other substances. ASA submitted its formal comments on CBD and urged the FDA to use its traditional rulemaking process to remove CBD from the drug schedules, because there already is a process in place that the FDA could use in its traditional rulemaking process to start the rescheduling process.
All right, Jehan. Well, we've talked about the international level with the World Health Organization, the federal level with the DEA and the DOJ. Let's get down to the state level here in the United States. What can you tell us about what's happening with medical cannabis across the nation?
Well, ASA has released a report on the medical cannabis programs in the U.S., where we grade each program and assign them letter grades based on points for different things. So some of the big news, though, is West Virginia joins medical cannabis states with Senate Bill 386, known as the West Virginia Medical Cannabis Act, and it goes into effect July 18th. Physicians who register with the program will be able to recommend cannabis to patients with serious medical conditions ranging from seizures to muscle spasms. Home cultivation will not be allowed. Smoking is banned, but vaporization and other methods are permitted. Indiana and Wisconsin have enacted limited CBD laws for seizures. So in Wisconsin, that's Governor Walker signed Senate Bill 10, allowing CBD extracts to be used in the treatment of seizures. It was unanimously passed in the assembly, 98-0. So it covers possession and use of CBD, but production or sale of it will remain illegal. So this is one of those manna from heaven bills where you're just supposed to kind of wait for the CBD to fall out of the sky.
Yeah, the immaculate conception, I suppose, right. Somehow.
Indiana as well passed another unanimous bill in the state, and it was a 3-1 margin in the Senate. And so basically, again, it's a very similar program. They can register the state to use CBD oil, though there's no provision for production or distribution. We also saw Virginia expanding the program, Hawaii dispensaries opening, and Guam has started licensing business and mandating patient-focused certification for these businesses.
All right, let's wrap things up here with a look at what's happening with your patient-focused certification. I know that's something that you guys are promoting, and tell us what's the latest.
Well, recently we've helped certify 20 businesses and trained hundreds of industry professionals in California, Delaware, Florida, Maryland, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and in District of Columbia. And so we've been putting a lot of content up for the public, including special guest lectures by Ethan Russo, one of the world's leading experts on clinical trials in cannabis. John McKay, who shared his 30 years of experience with laboratory analysis with us. So we have some free content that we're starting to put on the YouTube page. But we are holding another training, which will focus on dispensary and cultivation staff at the end of the month. And this is going to focus on the usual stuff you need to run a successful cannabis operation, but also on an intense workshop on federal law enforcement interactions, police interactions. And I think the crowd's going to have a lot of fun because we are dusting off ACE's old raid training to bring that back in a more functional manner. So, you know, typically these trainings are PowerPoint presentations, but back when I worked at a dispensary, you know, we would dress up as police with wooden guns and really train the staff on how to deal with these situations. And so this was a regular occurrence, is to get ready for these things. And so we are, you know, in anticipation of sessions getting its way, we have been adapting our training to this changing landscape.
Yeah, it's a shame we have to go back to raid training. We were hoping those days were over, but everything old is new again, apparently.
Yeah, and I think that even if you're in a state where you feel like it's a low risk, education and training are always good. You know, you don't want to get fined or you don't want to have issues in the workplace. You want to make sure your staff know what they can and can't say with patients, how to deal with people. But the basics of customer service are always good to work on too, in addition to raid trainings.
Yeah, good point. Well, Dr. Jehan Marku, Chief Science Officer for Americans for Safe Access, thanks again for joining us on the patient-focused update, and we'll talk to you again real soon.
Sounds good.